Midstream.
The Palestinian resistance Hamas is dealing very cautiously with the U.S.-Israeli entity proposals regarding what is referred to as a humanitarian ceasefire. So far, mediators had not reached an agreement accepted by all parties. The situation became clearer with the White House's announcement of a daily four-hour ceasefire, but then Zionist Israel quickly clarified that it does not imply a cessation of military operations. You see, the U.S. proposal for a temporary four-hour ceasefire daily was a response to the desires of the Zionist regime, which does not want a ceasefire that could be seen as an achievement for the resistance or have negative implications on the political situation within Zionist Israel, internationally, as well as on the military level. Whichever way you look at it, Washington aims for one goal, pushing the Palestinian resistance of northern Gaza to leave towards the south, in line with the basic plan to displace all the inhabitants of the Gaza Strip. Washington is basically telling Palestinians to leave or die. The resistance in the Gaza Strip has already made it clear that it will not compel anyone to stay or move from the north to the south. The resistance already views this proposal as additional U.S. support for the Zionist regime, since it does not provide a comprehensive cessation of military operations and prohibits the provision of genuine humanitarian support to the Gaza population. The Zionist regime is now requesting more time to achieve field accomplishments that would present the Israeli occupation army with an image of victory. They emphasize that the idea of displacing the population of the Gaza Strip to the south practically means clearing the way for the occupation army to launch a more intensive destructive operation in the entire north, absolving them of any accountability for the carnage under the pretext of the absence of civilians. The Israeli entity's rejection of the ceasefire is not only related to the military situation, but also to pressure the resistance forces to release a number of Israeli entity settler detainees without any reciprocation. This announced temporary ceasefire does not even align with the essence of the ongoing talks on multiple levels, including discussions in Cairo with the delegation of the Hamas leadership and meetings in Doha between the CIA Director William Burns, Mossad Chief David Bernier, and Qatari Prime Minister Mohammed bin Abdulrahman Al Thani. What the Americans haven't explicitly stated is that the one-sided ceasefires and potential agreements come as a result of U.S. pressure, primarily stemming from the failure of the Israeli occupation forces to achieve any significant battlefield accomplishments that could be used in negotiations. This suggests that the Israeli regime may soon be compelled to reassess its objectives to align with the outcome of the battles on the ground where Zionist Israel is seriously suffering. Welcome to the Mideast Stream. I'm Marwa Osman. Tens of thousands of Palestinians fled northern Gaza last week as the World Health Organization warns of worrying trends and the risk of disease after weeks of Israeli occupation airstrikes. The increasing evacuation came as Israeli occupation forces closed in on the center of Gaza City, launching intense bombardment campaigns and claiming that the resistance of Hamas had lost control of the north of the Gaza Strip. To discuss this issue with us from Cairo is Mr. Paul Larudi, founder of the Free Palestine Movement and the Free Gaza Movement. It's always a pleasure having you on board with us, Mr. Paul. Now, the pace of Palestinian civilians fleeing the combat zone in northern Gaza has picked up as Zionist Israel's air and ground campaign there intensified under the patronage, obviously, of the United States of America, who supposedly announced a one-sided ceasefire aimed at practically just emptying north of Gaza from its residents. How likely is it that we will see that Palestinian exodus happening again in other areas in Gaza, mainly in the center of Gaza and the south of Gaza?
Well, a lot depends. I mean, people do want to preserve their lives. And when the Israeli military is bombing everywhere, they'll try to seek safety where they can. We're not talking about the military here. We're talking about civilians who want to save their families and their children and this sort of thing. And can they be pushed, for example, into the Sinai? I imagine that with enough destruction, Israel would be able to do that if Egypt permits the border to open for that. But that there's no sign that that's going to happen. So they're really caught in a situation where they have to run away from wherever the danger is, but there's no place to go.
I hear that. Support the idea of displacing the Palestinians of Gaza Strip in the south practically means basically just clearing the way for the Zionist occupation army to launch a more intensive destructive campaign in the entire north, preparing for the complete invasion of Gaza. However, the situation on the ground tells another story of extensive Israeli occupation army defeat. So what's the end game here then for the Zionists and the US administration? When is it enough for them to say, that's it, we're done?
I don't know what it means to say, that's it, we're done, because I can't imagine that, let's face it, the resistance forces are extremely well prepared with the type of weapons that they're using and the strategy, and they've made a lot of the Zionist effort useless. Each time the Zionists think that they have bombed the resistance into oblivion, they send their soldiers in, and their soldiers get massacred because the resistance is prepared. So the only thing they can fall back on is to a complete genocide and ethnic cleansing, and that's what they're doing. They have no other strategy than to try to massacre thousands, tens of thousands, perhaps eventually even hundreds of thousands of people. Who knows? But they're not making much headway against the resistance.
Mm-hmm. Well, all of this suggests that maybe the Israeli regime will soon have to be compelled to reassess its objectives in Gaza to align at least with the outcomes of the results of the battlefield. But does that mean that a prisoner swap might be in the horizon? And if so, if that actually happens, if a ceasefire happens and the prisoner swap happens, what guarantees that Palestinians will have that after the swap, the Israeli entity will not just launch another ground invasion and another bombardment campaign against Gaza?
I think the prospect of a swap is a realistic one, because obviously, the government, Netanyahu and his cronies, are failing on the battlefield, and they're highly criticized by the people themselves, the Zionist population, and this is a way of perhaps regaining some credibility that they're not totally ineffective. So that's a possibility. As far as using massive destruction against the population after such a swap, if it ever takes place, I think the possibilities of massive destruction are equally great with or without a swap. They have what they call the Hannibal Directive, where if they think it's in their interest, they will actually bombard the place where the hostages are and their own soldiers if they think that they can gain by doing so. Let's face it, they have no respect for Palestinian life, and how much more respect do they have for the lives of their own people? I don't see it. I think they're willing to sacrifice
people. They already did that. We had a lot of reports coming from the resistance of Hamas saying that a number of the Israeli settler detainees were killed because of the aerial bombardment campaign by the Zionist entity. But Paul, you are now the founder of Free Palestine Movement and the founder of Free Gaza Movement. What are the efforts that you are trying to do in support of the Palestinian people, and what kind of maybe moral support are you bringing on with you from the United States of America towards the Palestinian people?
Well, we feel we have with us very talented people in terms of doing resistance and doing exercise and publicizing, and we have journalists, we have human rights activists and so forth. They're talented, but we're at a loss right now to figure out exactly how much we can get done. There are restrictions, of course, by the government in Egypt. Access to Rafah is very limited. But what we can do and what we are doing is we're demonstrating what the world is saying. We have millions of demonstrators across the world crying out to save the Palestinians and to stop the genocide. And I think that if we can get some of this action on the scene here in Cairo and perhaps elsewhere, then this will help to dramatize the concerns of the people of the world, and this will be reflected hopefully in action by at least some governments.
Do you think that your government will have any sort of an attempt to hear you out, to hear what the American public wants to say about this?
At a certain point, they have to. The demonstrations in the U.S. Are the biggest since the Iraq War, and it's really dramatic. The Palestinians have not always had very much success in the United States, but they are having it now, and this is very interesting. This is quite a turn, and especially the young people. It's young people who are turning out on the streets. So we're at a point where anything can happen. It's a very fluid situation. Mm-hmm. And the more we can get our voice and action in front of the people and the government, the more chance we have of making some sort of progress and headway. So that's we're trying everything.
Good luck with what you're doing, Paul Arudi, founder of the Free Palestine Movement and the Free Gaza Movement. Thank you for joining us to discuss this very, very pressing issue currently going on in Palestine. Thanks a million. Now, ladies and gents, please stay tuned, because next we are going to talk about the Arab Islamic Summit in Riyadh.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marwa Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
The concluding statement of the Arab Islamic Summit held in Riyadh on Saturday called for lifting the siege on Gaza and ensuring the immediate entry of Arab, Islamic, and international humanitarian convoys, including food, medicine, and fuel into the sector. I'm sorry if I'm not too excited about that result, but here are more details in this following report.
A disagreement occurred among the foreign ministers of Arab countries during their meeting on Thursday, November 9, in preparation for the Arab summit that was supposed to take place separately from the Islamic summit on Saturday in Riyadh. Just hours before the scheduled summit, Saudi Arabia announced on Friday evening the merging of the two summits, originally planned to host extraordinary meetings of the Organization of Islamic Cooperation and the Arab League on Saturday and Sunday. However, the Arab foreign ministers who convened on Thursday for summit preparation were divided. Some countries, led by Algeria, called for cutting all diplomatic ties with Zionist Israel. The delegates added that a group of Arab countries that had established diplomatic relations with the Israeli entity opposed this move, emphasizing the need to keep channels open with the Israeli regime. Meanwhile, in the concluding statement on Saturday evening, the Emergency Arab Islamic Summit called for a halt to the war in Gaza, rejecting the Israeli entity's justification for its actions against Palestinians as self-defense. The summit condemned Israeli entity aggression on the Gaza Strip and the heinous, savage, and inhumane war crimes committed by the colonial occupation government. The statement also called for lifting the blockade on Gaza, allowing the entry of Arab, Islamic, and international humanitarian aid convoys into the territory, and halting the export of weapons and ammunition to the Israeli entity. Among the prominent participants were Syrian President Bashar al-Assad, Egyptian President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi, Jordan's King Abdullah II, Qatari Emir Tamim bin Hamad al-Thani, Iranian President Ibrahim Raisi, and Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan. Iranian President Ibrahim Raisi emphasized that Gaza is witnessing the worst crimes committed in history, which reflects a collapse of ethics and humanity. President Raisi reiterated that the Israeli entity violates international laws in the Gaza Strip and a decisive historical decision regarding what is happening in Palestinian territories is what Palestine needs now. Meanwhile, Syrian President Bashar al-Assad stated that Arabs and Muslims today face unprecedented historical responsibilities because Gaza is not the issue, rather, all of Palestine is the issue. President Assad declared that any plan undertaken in this Arab summit is meaningless unless the summit has effective tools of pressure against Zionist Israel. Although such important statements were made, however, over approximately 70 years, 62 Arab summits have been convened, with 14 of them labeled as emergency summits, including the latest held to address the Gaza Strip genocide. Contrary to the expectation that an emergency summit would address immediate crises, the term is used here 36 days after the aggression against Gaza began, raising questions about the urgency of the response with a huge gap evident between the rhetoric coming from normalizing Arab and Islamic states and their actions in support of Palestine.
Now to discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Dr. Omar Nashabi, political analyst and lawyer, expert in human rights, and supervisor of the Al-Qaws supplement, which is published weekly with the Lebanese daily newspaper Al-Akhbar. Thanks a million, Dr. Nashabi, for being with us this morning. Now, contrary to the expectation that an emergency summit would address immediate crises, Riyadh's emergency Arab and Islamic summit was held 36 days after the aggression, the genocide, the killing, the bombardment of Gaza had already started, raising questions about the urgency of that summit after nearly 15,000 deaths, 5,000 of whom are infants, toddlers, and children. What took them so long?
Well, I can think of five reasons. I'm going to talk about them, one after the other briefly, because I can talk about this for like hours, but I'm going to try to be brief. First, obviously, they didn't think it was an emergency. After, one of the most densely populated areas in the world, 2.2 million people living in 360 square kilometers, being bombed continuously for 36 days, more than 30,000 tons of bombs thrown on these people, and they're Arab, they're Muslim, and the joint emergency Arab-Islamic conference took 36 days to convene. So obviously the first question that they consider this an emergency or not. The second is that some of them who are doing naturalization of relations with Israel, who hope that this will end sooner and that the Gazan resistance would collapse and it would end sooner and they wouldn't have to do a conference in the first place. Or they would do a conference in order to regulate and see what the West needs for the new order in Gaza. And, this is what the West wants the conference to do. And the third is that they have so many disagreements among these states. Most of the states, are completely inactive, on the other hand, there is the Islamic Republic of Iran, there is Yemen, there is Iraq and Lebanon, and these are taking an advanced stance to defend the resistance, whereas the other Arab countries have a total opposite position. Mm-hmm. Maybe they don't express it that, they don't articulate it that loudly at this point because of the bloodbath in Gaza, but they have an opposite position. Fear, perhaps, of some of the Arab and Islamic leaders that maybe if they would convene a conference very fast and they would have a high tone, it would maybe fuel more the popular support for the Palestinian resistance in their own country, and it could threaten their leadership, because most of these countries, unfortunately, they're not exactly democracies. They're more likely, dictatorships ruled by the system of intelligence that controls their population.
Mm-hmm. Well, Nashabi, the least that could result from a summit like this was at least concrete actions, such as severing ties, diplomatic ties with Zionist entity, maybe economic boycotts, for example, and taking a strong stance against international companies that are dealing with the Zionist entity in the midst of this catastrophe and this genocide. What was reflected in the closing statement of this summit? I mean, how is it helpful for the Palestinians?
Well, the closing statement of this summit, this emergency Arab-Islamic summit, is more like a report by a human rights NGO with very general recommendations, with no concrete action, nothing concrete. You know, they wanted to be sure to move away from any disagreements between the nations that are participating in this conference. So therefore, it's fair to say that it's meaningless. What they came out with are general recommendations without any practical follow-up. So nothing on the boycott, nothing on stopping, naturalized relationships with Israel from some Arab nations, or a call for calling the Israeli ambassador or calling the diplomatic mission and showing a strong, stance or, some actions that are direct. There was no mention of any concrete action, and that makes the statement, the final statement, so insignificant. There was nothing, Egypt has a border with Gaza. There's a border in Rafah. They said, yeah, we should pressure on, for the humanitarian assistance to go in from Rafah. But they didn't give any practical force that could actually, make sure that the border with Rafah is open and
a nation with 120 million Arabs cannot open a border, for the love of God.
And all the Islamic nations, I think they would support this. This is a humanitarian call. I mean, they could support it. They could send perhaps delegations of observers. I'm not talking about military. Delegations of observers to the Rafah area to make sure that all the aid is going in. Now all the aid is not going in, or very little, it's all under, Israeli control.
Yeah, how can all these Arab and Islamic nations accept that? We do see the long lines of trucks standing there, and most of the aid is either going bad or is not getting to the Palestinian side
and the Palestinians,
in Gaza.
And every day they need it more. You have to remember the winter is coming. There are, hundreds of thousands of people that have no shelter, nothing. And I'm not talking about the hospitals. Mm-hmm. People are dying in the hospitals, and, they take these decisions that are so general and impractical and as if nothing happened.
Exactly.
Netanyahu, before the Israeli prime minister, before the summit, said that the Arab nations should rather stay silent. I wish they stayed silent. They did worse than that. They surrendered completely by calling for peace, going back to the peaceful negotiation, not asking for any sort of accountability for these mass crimes committed by the Israelis. Everybody's witnessing these mass crimes. They are violations, basic and violent violations of, the basic humanitarian laws.
What you're talking about, Dr. Nashavi, was mentioned in the word by Syrian President Bashar Assad,
yes,
one of the most important speeches given on Saturday, when he said that... by the way, his own country is under attack by the Zionist entity and the Americans as we speak as well. But he was asserting that the Arab world has the potential, we have the potential to reshape the narrative in favor of Palestine. But he said that if nothing really viable comes out, then it's meaningless. And this is what you're saying. What is stopping the rest of the Arab world to adopt at least a similar stance or approach like that of Syria?
Well, the Syrian president gave direct recommendations. He said that there should be concrete action to make the actual humanitarian supplies go into Gaza from Rafah. He said that there should be a stop for the naturalization process with the Israelis. And he talked about, taking advantage of what's happening to advance our political agenda. No, they're not going to respond to that because they think that, and let's be very, frank about this. Syria paid a heavy price for its positions. Syria has always had these positions that are, more practical, more, calling for, justice in the area and taking concrete actions. And I think
it
Syria
is still
paid,
paying. I mean, the morning of Monday, the United States of America had airstrikes on their door.
Yes, exactly. And I think that every position, this position by President Assad and the position of Syria to support the resistance, is a very courageous decision. And Syria has been paying the price, and it will continue to pay the price. and any country that decides to call for justice in a concrete way, not mm-hmm. in a, you know, in a kind of folkloric kind of, you know, just a verbal kind of NGO statement mm-hmm. for, you know, solidarity with Palestine, that's allowed. But any concrete action to support the Palestinian people and support the resistance and justice will be, you know, faced by very aggressive Western action supported by some of its allies in the Arab and Islamic world.
Mm-hmm. Well, Dr. Omar Nashabi, political analyst and lawyer, expert in human rights, supervisor of the Al-Qaws supplement, which is published weekly with the Lebanese daily newspaper Al-Akhbar. I want to thank you very much for the immense helpful and amazing information that you gave us in support of the Palestinian people and in showing how this so-called emergency Arab-Islamic summit was actually an embarrassment, I'm afraid to say. Well, ladies and gents, thank you. See you again soon next week from the Mideast Stream. Assalamu alaikum.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Limelight. In Britain, charities warned makeshift refugee camps are likely to spring up across England this winter as an unprecedented number of those newly granted the right to remain are sleeping rough after speeded up Home Office evictions. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Independent has covered this story and tells us more. New analysis suggested more than 50,000 refugees in the United Kingdom could become homeless by the end of the year, with many already living on the streets in tents because of shrinking government support. Refugees who are granted asylum were previously given 28 days by the Home Office to find somewhere new to live, set up a bank account, and find a job or apply for universal credit before they are kicked out of their government-funded hotel. But some have as little as 7 days because the government is delaying giving asylum seekers the documents that they need to try and secure housing. A lack of affordable housing and an increase in the number of asylum grants being made is putting increasing demand on homelessness charities. The British Red Cross has estimated that 53,100 refugees will be at risk of homelessness this winter if the government clears all legacy asylum applications by the end of the year, as it has promised. The charity British Red Cross has warned even if the backlog is not cleared on time, an estimated 26,000 people could still be at risk of destitution and homelessness. Refugees are given 7 days' notice of their eviction from Home Office hotels and cannot usually get housing support from their local authority without the letter. Local councils are also prioritising families for help, leaving many single male refugees to live homeless on the street. Since the changes at the beginning of August, the British Red Cross services have seen a 140% increase in destitution for refugees they support, from 132 in June and July to 317 people in August and September. The charity Refugees at Home which matches refugees with rooms, has seen referrals increase from 70 last September to 223 last month. Carly Wyborn, Executive Director of Refugees at Home, said, "Since the changes, we have had a fivefold increase in the number of referrals from refugees desperate for somewhere to live, and the situation is getting worse. We're urgently trying to reach out to new hosts, particularly in major cities, who may be able to offer a temporary place to stay." Frank Foreman, director of Nottingham Refugee Forum, said in its last 10 drop-in sessions it had seen 60 new refugees presented as homeless. Frank Foreman added, "It has been suggested that there will be over 4,000 questionnaires processed in the East Midlands by December, of which around 1,000 will be in Nottingham. The prospect of even half that number presenting to use as homeless is a challenge we're not sure how to respond to." Homelessness Charity Network, NAACOM, reported 2022-2023 was the first time since it started collecting data a decade ago that more than half the adults given help were refugees. Alex Fraser at British Red Cross said, "Once people get refugee status, they need more time, not less, to find housing, to find work and benefits. It takes at least 35 days to start getting universal credit, and local authorities need at least 56 days to help them find accommodation." A Home Office spokesperson said, "We do not recognise these forecasts. All asylum applications are considered on their individual merits." The Home Office spokesperson added, "We encourage individuals to make their onward plans as soon as possible after receiving their decision, whether that is leaving the UK following a refusal or taking steps to integrate in the United Kingdom following a grant. We provide support for refugees to access jobs, benefits and housing." The British newspaper The Guardian has also covered the same story and tells us more. Charities warned makeshift refugee camps are likely to spring up across England this winter as an unprecedented number of those newly granted the right to remain are sleeping rough after speeded-up Home Office evictions. In July, newly recognised refugees and survivors of trafficking had the number of days they had to find a new place to live after receiving a notice to quit before being evicted from Home Office accommodation cut from 28 days to 7 days after their claim was approved. Since then, refugee and homelessness charities and local authorities say there has been an acceleration in the number of asylum decisions made and a sharp rise in the number of refugees seeking help for homelessness. The Home Office said it had recruited a record number of asylum decision makers, with 40% more in post than in December of 2022. Local authorities have said the majority of refugees who have approached councils for help are single males, who they say are not deemed priority need, meaning local councils have no duty to provide anything more than advice and assistance. Charities have warned camps of homeless refugees could appear in towns and cities across the country in the coming months. Shana Roberts, the manager of the Merseyside Refugee Support Network in Liverpool, said, "I've never seen anything like this in my 25 years in the sector. Normally, we might have seen one or two people present themselves as street homeless in a year. Now we've got 50 people in the space of 6 weeks." Shana Roberts said she had handed out sleeping bags to a number of refugees in the past 6 weeks. She added, "They chose not to take tents because they didn't want to be visible or feel vulnerable in the park." The Guardian spoke to refugees from Eritrea, who has been sleeping rough in the centre of Nottingham since he was granted refugee status more than a month ago. He said, "I've been sleeping in a sleeping bag and wearing a lot of clothes. It has been very cold and I haven't been healthy. The cold has made me vomit. I'm scared of sleeping outside. There are many other refugees doing the same as me. When it is the middle of the winter, it will be much worse." Nottingham Refugee Forum said the situation in the city had worsened in the past month. A spokesperson for the Nottingham Refugee Forum said, "We're seeing high numbers of new refugees who are street homeless or are at risk of this." The forum claimed gloves, toothbrush, toothpaste, soap, and deodorant. Recently, the BBC reported that two recently recognized refugees from Sudan and Syria who were evicted from Home Office accommodation 7 days after being granted leave to remain have been camping outside council offices in West Berkshire. Maggie Filipova-Rivers, a reader for the City of Sanctuary UK, said similar situations were likely to occur in the coming months. She added, "This is kind of what it will look like, and we're likely to see this happening on quite a large scale." In North London, Islington Council said 126 refugees had presented as homeless in the past 5 weeks. Before mid-August, one refugee a month on average presented as homeless to the council.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed? Smiling, he would say, I am a Muslim.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of God, welcome to another edition of the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio, in which we try to ask and answer some of the questions related to the Islamic laws based on the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. But before we embark on our episode, let's take a listen to a short biography. A little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hawza studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtadha Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, "We testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, That's the first year that he started his Bahth al-Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching makasas, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up to 1347, he was actively participating in Bahth al-Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahth al-Kharij, he started Bahth al-Kharij and he's teaching, one can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that.
Back to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javed, our guest speaker. We are talking about some of the jurisprudential laws about wudu based on the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khomeini with Sheikh Javed. Sheikh Javed, assalamu alaikum, and welcome to the studio.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Well, we have covered some questions regarding wudu in the previous episode, Sheikh Javed, with you. And let me ask you, or start off this episode actually, with a question regarding the recommended wudu. My first question is that, is that kind of wudu different from the kind of obligatory wudu first?
Obviously, the recommended wudu is no different from the obligatory wudu because they are performed in the same way. And the recommended wudu is sufficient for the obligatory prayers, you know, contrary to what many people think or believe that, okay, recommended wudu may not suffice for the obligatory wudu. Mm-hmm. Of course, I would say that according to the religious authorities, it's always recommended to be in a state of ritual purity,
right.
Tahara.
Right.
And of course, when you are in the state of Tahara, you can perform prayers, you can perform any act of religious duties which require wudu or Tahara.
Sheikh Javed, apart from the intention which we may actually before or prior to any kind of act, religious act, ritual act, right?
Yes.
That we Muslims do. Apart from the intention, is there any way in which they are different? I mean, the way we perform the wudu, is it different from the obligatory ones?
They do not differ at all from right. each other. They are performed in the same way. And the same rule which applies to the obligatory wudu does apply to the recommended wudu. Mm-hmm. They are not different.
I see. So, and you are also stating that it's valid, actually, to perform, actually, let's say, a prayer, I mean, obligatory daily prayer with recommended wudu,
sure.
right?
Sure.
And what about the vice versa?
Of course, it makes no difference because when you perform wudu for the obligatory prayers and it's time for prayer, you perform wudu for the obligatory prayers. You can use the same tahara, the same wudu, to perform as many prayers as you would like to. For example, you can perform nawafil. You can keep on praying and praying. You know, there is no problem.
I see. Well, my next question is about incontinence, Sheikh Javed. What about those people who cannot control their urine or abdomen? They pass wind every now and then and they cannot maintain a state of ritual purity which is required for prayer. So would you talk about that medical condition aspect?
You're right. Of course, incontinence is a problem many people face, whether it comes to passing wind or, not controlling one's bowel. And there are many elderly people who do suffer from this problem. So the Islamic Sharia has said that, okay, in the event that a person cannot restrain himself from passing wind, and he constantly passes wind, even if he tries to, in that case, he's not supposed to renew his wudu. He can go on praying with the same wudu. He's not supposed to stop praying and make wudu again and again because he cannot control his, right. his bowel. And of course, the rules which apply to a person who's suffering from incontinence and who is not able to control passing wind, the same rules apply to someone who suffers from, let's say, flatulation, from some kind of from a disease which does not allow him to control
gastric problems.
Yeah, the abdomen, as you rightly mentioned.
All right, thank you very much, Javid. And let's take a short break, and we'll be back and continue our program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. Stay with us.
The followers of Ayatollah Khomeini can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khomeini's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Allah, yeah, Allah. Guide me all the way to your Jannah, ya Allah, oh Allah. Don't let me go astray, cause I need you.
Back to the program, Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio, with me, Mahajad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. The topic that we are still lingering on is wudu and some of the jurisprudential laws based on the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khomeini regarding wudu. Sheikh Javid, let me ask you a question regarding muwalat. Is succession required to make wudu?
Yeah, that's a pretty good question, you know. Muwalat, or the consecutiveness of each act of prayer, is mandatory. It is necessary because each part of the wudu should follow the other part, and they should be performed in quick succession. There should not be excessive delay between one part and another part, which otherwise would cause one part of the wudu to become dry. For example, your hands, or maybe your face will be dry, and then if you need moisture, you will not be able to take it from your face. So contrary to wudu or ghusl, in which succession is not required, of course, wudu requires succession, quick succession. So when it comes to ghusl, of course, we can perform, you can wash your head and neck, for example, in the morning, your body, your right side of your body, in the afternoon, and then there's no problem whatsoever if there's any delay taking place, okay? Right. So if, for example, we see that if a part of your body is dry, okay, dry, and you learn after sometimes that, okay, a part of your body is dry, then it's not necessary to do the ghusl all over again. So you just need to wash that dry part with the intention of completing ghusl, and there's no objection to you whatsoever.
Sheikh Javid, is washing the interior part of the ears recommended for wudu?
It's not recommended, you know. Of course, what is recommended is to just rinse your mouth, okay? Rinse your mouth, okay? Wash your teeth. But, you know...
Washing or brushing?
Wash, okay? Because during wudu, you cannot brush your teeth.
Yes.
But when it comes to washing the interior of your ears, contrary to Sunni Muslims, because I've seen Sunni Muslims even washing... you know, pressing their fingers into their ears to remove the dirt or wash the interior of their ears. We are not required to do that. It's not a mustahab. It's not a recommended act to wash the interior of your ears. So just washing your face and also rinsing your mouth And these are the parts, that, these are the things that you need to do, but raising your mouth is not wajib, it is a recommended act.
Sheikh Javid, we don't have much time, less than 2 minutes. I wanted to ask you just to list us, in fact, some of the invalidators of wudu. You know, we have talked about lots of things about the wudu, but the invalidators. Would you please shed some light on it?
Well, when it comes to the invalidating agents, there are many things that invalidate wudu. One of them is, of course, urinating, you know, defecating, you know, and discharging wind, you know, as sleep, which is deep enough to, you know, to prevent any kind of hearing, you know. If you just fall to sleep or go to sleep, and your senses still function and they are active. For example, you still hear the sound around you, and if there are people walking around you, still have you just sense it. So that is not that does not invalidate your wudu. Okay, the sleep. Okay, should be deep enough to prevent any kind of hearing or, you know, sensation or something like that. Now, of course, there are other invalidating agents, like, for example, masturbation, you know.
Ejaculation. Of semen.
Sexual intercourse.
What about bleeding?
Bleeding. What kind of bleeding do you mean? Okay, if your nose bleeds, okay, if your body parts because of injury, because of a kind of wound.
Yes. It doesn't
bleeds,
affect
it does wudu. Not affect your wudu.
But menstrual bleeding.
Course, menstrual bleeding. Okay, the blood discharge which happens after childbirth.
Mm.
Or you call it postnatal bleeding.
Yes. Mm.
And these are, obviously, there's no doubt that they invalidate the wudu.
Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. And thank you, my dear listeners, for joining us on the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio, in which we try to deal with some of the jurisprudential laws related to wudu based on the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khomeini. Thank you very much for listening to us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
رحمن رحيم منان كريم سلام عليم لا إله إلا هو غفار جميل وهاب لطيف تواب سميع بصير لا إله إلا هو رحيم محيي مميت الظاهر والباطن لا إله إلا هو لا إله إلا هو.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAD 5 and Intelsat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is pastoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
The headlines, 42 days into the Israeli war on Gaza, more Palestinians lose their lives in intense airstrikes by